KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
When a scientist comes from a community that is on fire, facing oppression or violence or famine or genocide or anything like that, that scientist can't focus on their science. And when their science is in service to the planet, is helping to create a healthy, thriving ecosystem, then we all lose. We do not lead single issue lives, so we cannot look at a single issue struggle. It's not save the whales, right? It's we are nature and we are saving ourselves.
In this program, Dr. Ray Wynn Grant shares her personal odyssey as a wildlife ecologist, conservation biologist, and co-host of the famed TV nature show, Wild Kingdom. As a scientist dedicated to protecting and conserving the diversity of the web of life, she reminds us that as human beings, we are part of nature. It's all connected, and it's high time to bring about peaceful coexistence, not only with nature, but with one another. This is Saving Nature Means Saving Ourselves. I'm your host, Neil Harvey. Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. Beginning around 2020, a significant global political movement began to crystallize to bring about the large-scale conservation of the lands and waters on which the biological diversity that underpins the web of life depends, including human beings. This movement was inspired partly by the late biologist E.O. Wilson's 2016 book, Half Earth, in the stark shadow of what scientists call the sixth age of extinctions. Running at 1,000 times the natural rate, today's mass extinction event is the first caused by the human hand. A growing global consortium of scientists, activists, NGOs, governments, policymakers, and indigenous peoples is working to translate the best contemporary science, as well as traditional ecological knowledge, into actual practical goals to conserve half the Earth's lands and waters by 2050. This movement reflects a historic paradigm shift. What we do to the Earth, we do to ourselves. Dr. Ray Wynn Grant further suggests that what we do to each other, we do to the Earth. In other words, social justice is imperative for us to achieve ecological well-being. Telling that new story of interdependence is her life's work. When she became co-host of the long-running program Wild Kingdom, Ray fulfilled a dream she had since childhood.
I'm about to do something you're never supposed to do. You should never disturb a hibernating bear and never get between a mother bear and her cubs. But today, I'm part of an important conservation research project, and we're about to come face to face with wild bears.
I can already see a little cub. It's like a light, kind of a grayish color. I gotta get in there.
Okay, we've got two. We've got two, hello. And we've got three newborn cubs to this mama.
Her memoir, Wildlife, Finding My Purpose in an Untamed World, chronicles her improbable dream of a career marrying storytelling, science, and the great outdoors. Dr. Ray Wynn Grant spoke at a Bioneers conference.
Before I was Miss Wilderness, I was a little urban kid, and I had an extremely urban upbringing, which I think is a good thing. I'm very proud of that. But I grew up with parents who lived in the big city. We went on trips to other big cities, and my whole world was urban. And that was enough for me. I loved it, right? I saw, you know, the occasional pigeon and squirrel, maybe a couple earthworms, and that was great. Ironically, the place where I really became super passionate about nature was indoors. It was by watching TV. It was sitting on the floor of my grandparents' living room here in the Bay Area and watching nature shows. And they took me to Africa and Australia, Asia, South America, kind of everywhere but, you know, the United States, and showed me these incredible landscapes and these creatures that needed protection. And when I was a little kid, I said, I want to be a nature show host. I want to do what these British and Australian guys are doing. And my family was very supportive. They're kind of like, oh, you know, I guess it could be worse. That's fine. Never heard of it, but that's fine. And I took that desire all the way through college.
As Ray entered college, once again, her unusual vision hung in midair, looking for a place to land.
And I have this distinct memory of entering college and going to my advisor's office on the first week of my freshman year and saying, I want to be a nature show host. What do I have to major in to do that? And my advisor was stumped and said, I don't know, maybe theater? Journalism, maybe? And then finally arrived at environmental science. What about environmental science? And I said, never heard of it, but sounds good. And I dove into environmental science, which was the exact right place for me to land. And I found, for the first time, as you know, a freshman in college, that those nature shows that I was watching as a kid and as a teenager were introducing me to science. And that was a fit for me. Until a couple years into it, I thought to myself, you know what's missing, though, is that I've never been outside. There's something about reading about forests and savannas in a textbook and seeing animals on a PowerPoint that just doesn't quite hit. And I realized this, and so at 20 years old, I got outside, and I signed myself up for a study abroad program. I again went back to that same advisor in college and said, I need the most hardcore wildlife ecology study abroad program you can find, and they did. And I landed in southern Kenya.
In Kenya, Ray began deepening her craft in the field. She lived for a semester as part of a community of students in a Maasai village in one of Kenya's awe-inspiring national parks. But then, as the saying goes, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans.
Now, this was 2005 in southern Kenya. The world had the internet, Kenya had the internet, but not in the bush where we were living. So mail was sparse. But the very first package that I got from my parents had letters and postcards and some CDs that they sent me. And it also had this edition of Time magazine, because while I had been away, Hurricane Katrina had occurred in the Gulf of Mexico and Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi. And almost 1,000 people perished in that tragedy. And it was a highly racialized event, right? People who were evacuated didn't necessarily look like the people who weren't evacuated. The people who died didn't reflect the people who lived. And there it was, just enveloped in this passion for wildlife ecology, reading this article and crying around the campfire. And folks from the Maasai community that also served as the staff for the program came over to comfort me and to ask me questions. And they said to me, so why are you here? You're all the way across oceans and continents studying our wildlife, but it looks like your people and your community at home really need some help. And it was at that moment that I realized that I couldn't shake that passion for wildlife ecology. There's nothing I could do. I was in it. I got that spark. But because of my identity, I would never be able to solely do this science work in that vacuum as I had been taught. My personal identity as a Black American millennial woman would mean that I would always be concerned for social justice at the same time, if not more, than the work that I was doing with wild animals. And I needed a way for that to be okay, and for that to be a part of who I was and my work.
Returning to the U.S., Ray began building a career as one of the country's great large animal ecologists. Her special passion was black bears and grizzlies, and how humans impact them in the wild. As she neared the end of her PhD program at Columbia University in ecology and evolutionary biology, she alternated between living in New York City and studying black bears in the wilds of the western states. On her way to an ecology conference on the West Coast to deliver a talk about the threats to black bears, once again, life intervened.
And so I flew across the country, and there was news that a young black man named Michael Brown had just been shot and murdered by police in Ferguson, Missouri. And the people of Ferguson were outraged and they were protesting. Some media outlets would say they were rioting. And Ferguson was literally on fire. And this wasn't new, right? This was another example of police brutality to black communities that was getting more media attention before, because we have smartphones that can record it these days and body cams that can record it instead of in years past. And I found myself driving to the conference. I made the mistake of driving the day I was presenting. And I realized I was about to go in front of thousands of people, of ecologists, and talk about the mortality risk of black bears in America. And all I could think of was the mortality risk of black men in America at the same time. And I had this prop that you see in the picture for the conference. I thought, you know, let me jazz up my ecology talk a little bit with a prop. And it's a bear skull. And in the picture, I'm pointing to a bullet hole in the bear skull, where it was shot and killed by an intolerant and hostile person. And I brought it up there, and I bravely said, I'm here to talk about how this bear died. This is a bullet hole to its brain. But I'm so afraid that nobody cares about how Michael Brown died the day before with a bullet to his body. And these conversations need to be a part of the ecology community and the scientific community.
For Ray, the question became, how does science relate to justice, and vice versa?
My main point was that we care so much about science, and the people I was with supported science. I mean, there is no question. But did they support scientists? And I went on stage to say, if we will do anything for science, we have to offer that energy and that passion for scientists also. Scientists who are women, who are non-binary people, who are black and brown and immigrants and Muslim and from the LGBTQ plus community and any kind of oppressed group. And when a scientist comes from a community that is on fire, facing oppression or violence or famine or genocide or anything like that, that scientist can't focus on their science. And when their science is in service to the planet, is helping to create a healthy, thriving ecosystem, then we all lose. And I realized in this moment, and I called on my fellow ecologists to say, we have to have social justice at a minimum as a foundation for environmental solutions. Otherwise, we only have the most privileged people working on these solutions. And it's too slow. I was able to say that from a safe place. The cops weren't after me. You know, I realized that I always hold so much privilege to be able to make these confessions and announcements and epiphanies, but not everyone has that. There are so many people who don't know they're ecologists because they're dealing with the hardest things in life. And it is our duty to alleviate a lot of that so that we can all work together.
If what we do to each other we do to the earth, says Ray Wynn Grant, then social justice is a precondition for environmental solutions. Can we learn how to peacefully coexist with both the natural world and each other? More when we return. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. The Earth is increasingly becoming what the human species makes of it. Since 1970, there's been a mind-blowing collective decline of two-thirds of mammal, bird, fish, reptile, and amphibian populations. More than 80% of wild animals have disappeared. If we look at total Earth's biomass of mammals by weight, 96% is livestock and human beings. Nearly half of all habitable land is taken up by agriculture. Climate change radically disrupts natural cycles and already shrinking habitats, trapping wildlife within smaller land and marine areas. Less than a fifth of lands and inland waters are protected, and not even a tenth of marine areas. There are efforts to turn things around. The 30-30 Initiative is a global effort to conserve half of the Earth. Domestically, California is at the forefront, protecting 25% of lands and 16% of coastal waters. Dr. Ray Wynn Grant is working to understand how our human impacts on wildlife can be beneficial instead of destructive. As a TV personality reaching millions of engaged viewers, she tells these stories to inspire the same spark in others.
What I find is that often when speaking with people, whether it's one-on-one, whether it's presentation form, whether it's in the media, one thing that I often try to suggest is that wild animals are doing their very best to coexist with us. Are we doing our best to coexist with them? Because they're not trying to start problems. They don't want to be killed. They don't want to pick a fight. They really just want to eat something. The elephant that we saw blasting through that fence, the lions that ate the camels, the bears in your backyard getting into your bird feeder. Most of these animals really have a strong instinct to eat food. I think some of us can resonate with that. And so I honestly find that getting people to understand that we too are animals, we too are driven by the same instincts, we too build shelter, look for food, care for our young, build communities. We are nature and we're trying to save ourselves. We are actually all trying to coexist together. I mean, humans haven't figured out how to coexist with one another very well. Those are the extremely non-scientific, but I think very important messages that I feel compelled to offer to folks is that honestly, like, let's give these species the benefit of the doubt.
Before the 2020 pandemic, Ray spent several years studying grizzly bear movement and behavior on the Great Plains around Montana. Much of the land is fenced off by cattle ranches that make it very hard for wild grizzly bears to survive, much less thrive. Ray encountered fierce hostility, toward her beloved grizzlies from cattle ranchers whose families had occupied the land for generations. Although there's increasing openness among ranchers today toward holistic rangeland management that embraces coexistence with wildlife, the burdens of history still weigh heavy in the cattle culture.
I found, as I was studying these grizzly bears, that I had to interact with a lot of cattle ranchers and kind of tell them, okay, hi, I'm Ray, and I study grizzly bears that you probably think are going to eat your cattle, but I'd like to just set some camera traps up on this landscape to just see if they're already here, because we have reason to believe that they're already here. And I would have these conversations with folks about coexistence, and the conversations were all over the place, but I did encounter a number of cattle ranchers who said, my great-great-grandfather killed every grizzly bear he ever saw because they were a threat to the cattle. And if I let a grizzly bear on my ranch, that would be an insult to my family, to my great-great-grandfather, and all that effort he put in slaughtering wild animals. You know, and you can imagine me being like, oh, gosh, okay, noted. I'm going to move on to the next ranch.
Even after Ray presented bulletproof data that grizzlies ate only roots and plants and posed no threat to the cattle, these ranchers were unmoved and maintained their traditional war on grizzlies.
And that is my example of coexistence not working out. And so I found that coexistence didn't work in places where people were so rigid with their belief systems that were not able to have new information change their mind. This probably sounds familiar because we talk about it when it comes to politics, but it was really rough for the way I felt at the end of the day doing my job, trying to help. It was really difficult and painful, let alone knowing that most of the people who held this hostility towards wild animals that were referencing their family background were referencing a family background that only existed because of genocide and because of stealing land. And they were holding staunch in those very rigid and, in my words, violent beliefs. And that's part of an American story. But it doesn't mean we will continue down that path of failure. We can absolutely turn it around to a success.
The history of the conservation movement is itself complicated. In the U.S., the movement to create national parks defined wilderness as nature without people. It resulted in banishing the indigenous peoples, old-growth cultures who had lived there sustainably for centuries. Today, it's well documented that traditional cultures often measurably benefit their landscapes and enhance biodiversity. Almost all of the founders of the conservation movement were white, and many promoted overtly racist views, including white supremacy and eugenics. Often the goal of nature preserves was colonial, such as to create privileged game reserves for rich trophy hunters. In this light, the current conservation movement is explicitly beginning to recognize the sins of the past and to bring indigenous peoples into the decision-making process. In California's 30 by 30 initiative, the state has demonstrated ancestral land return in action, providing $100 million to tribes to regain almost 40,000 acres of traditional territories. Nevertheless, animals are on the run, and heedless human impacts are heartbreaking. Ray recalls one call she got while working as a biologist near Lake Tahoe. A hiker had found a bear who died under strange circumstances.
And so my colleague and I went to investigate, and we found a young black bear dead in a small stream, in a very shallow stream, about maybe 4 inches of water, so it couldn't have drowned. My colleague said, okay, in moments like this, we actually do a field necropsy, so we will open up the animal, and the first place we should explore is its stomach to see if maybe it ingested something that had killed it. But we opened the stomach of this young black bear in Tahoe in the middle of the forest. The stomach was full, and it was full of ketchup packets from the local fast food dumpster. And that young animal must have wandered from the forest to the dumpster that was open, devoured a lot of goodies, and crawled its way to the nearest stream to get some water to try to save its own life, and didn't. And man, that was a tough day, because one individual suffering meant that the population wasn't doing as great as we thought, and how the suffering of one individual can symbolize a huge problem. And essentially, this is not new, right? There have been many incredible scholars and thinkers who've articulated these ideas way better than me in the past, and Audre Lorde is one of my favorites. But we do not lead single-issue lives, so we cannot look at a single-issue struggle. It's not save the whales, right? It's we are nature, and we are saving ourselves. And it's okay if that focus is on people and communities and social justice. It's okay if that focus is on wild animals, but it needs to be comprehensive and radical.
Dr. Ray Wynn Grant knows up close and personal how dire the threats to wildlife are. Yet she also sees the epic paradigm shift underway that's radically changing the story and helping drive an unprecedented global popular movement to conserve half the Earth by 2050. She's using her torch to light other torches.
Whether it's TV or radio or books or social media, I often think social media gets a bad rep, but my goodness, my algorithm is a whole bunch of environmental justice information that I wouldn't get otherwise. You know, I think the power of non-traditional education, informal education, can really help people. It can be accessible to kids. It can be accessible to people from many different income backgrounds and many different languages and many different places. I, for one, would not be the career person that I am today without television shows. No one in my family or community or neighborhood and my low-income inner-city upbringing ever asked me, like, what kind of ecologist do you want to be? But I could ask myself that question because I watched TV, and it brought me to those places and allowed me to aim higher and want to be a part of a whole movement. There are so many important movements that I think different aspects of media can lend itself towards, and it helped me. And I've seen it help a lot of other people. I have this personal goal to make heroes out of environmentalists. I think that folks all over the world find heroes in, you know, fictional characters. They find heroes in athletes. They find heroes in entertainers. But I think, my gosh, if environmental scientists or other types of environmentalists could be household names as well across the world, we would be in much better shape.
Ray Wynn Grant. Saving nature means saving ourselves. Executive producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel and Leo Hornack. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Producer, Teo Grossman. Production assistants, Leo Hornack and Monica Lopez. And I'm host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 277.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
I'm standing on the deck of the Sea Shepherd vessel Allen K, staring out to sea. We're sailing south of Deception Island, making our way down the western coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, and this evening, we're being treated to a beautiful sunset after a day of freezing fog. This mountainous, snow-covered finger of the last continent, as it's called, stretches north into the Drake Passage, reaching out for Cape Horn and the southernmost tip of the Americas. Tracking a few miles offshore, we pick our way through a vast field of icebergs. Portside, the mountains are towering into and above the clouds. Starboard and out to sea, the waning light is illuminating 1,000 frozen sculptures in shades of gold and pink. the tranquility of our surroundings is a welcome change. We've been more than a month at sea, starting with a storm-ridden passage across the South Atlantic. Swells tower to 12 metres, causing the ship to pitch and roll violently. Spray swept across the decks, confining the 20 of us on board indoors for nearly a week before Neptune finally lost interest in us. I'm a volunteer crew member on this ship, and our mission is one of environmental activism, to bear witness to and document the fleet of super trawlers combing the seas around Coronation Island for krill, the foundational species of the Antarctic ecosystem. We shadowed the fleet as vessels over 100 meters long barged through pods of feeding whales, taking the food from their mouths. Krill trawlers keep their nets in the water continuously, using giant vacuums to suck out the entangled sea life. On board those floating factories, krill is ground and boiled. Some will eventually be fed to farmed salmon on Ireland's Atlantic coast. We followed the fleet for a week, and then the weather forecast told us to run for cover. We didn't quite make it to the peninsula before the storm caught us. Wind rushed over the decks, howling and whining. Icebergs the size of houses loomed alongside us. Our searchlights combed the waves all night for danger. Only now, in the aftermath, do we admit to each other, over bowls of hot soup, how little we slept, the fear we felt. Come 9 p.m. on the ship's clock, and the crew is dispersing for the evening. Common spaces quieten, and cabin doors close. I've ducked back into my cabin, and I'm starting to peel back my many layers of insulative clothing when the intercom sounds. The voice of French First Officer Baptiste crackles through from the bridge. All crew, all crew. Orcas on the bow. Before he can finish, you can hear doors slamming and thundering footsteps. The whole crew is scrambling towards the bow in shorts in place of thermal leggings and waterproof trousers, flip-flops or shoes with laces undone. The price for this hastiness is paid at once. A cold wind leaves exposed flesh, first numb, then stinging in pain. But the price of delay could be far greater. An opportunity missed, never to return. We chat nervously, scanning the smooth surface of the ocean until we see the orca blow again, at a bearing of 9 o'clock to us and a range of half a mile. Another blow, and then a towering black dorsal fin, unmistakable. We whoop and cheer as we see a whole family of orca, the ocean's apex predator, breathe in unison. The pod is transiting north, and after a few more sightings, their fins fade into the distance behind us. But the show goes on. Everything is more extreme at sea. Bad days are barely survivable. Gravity becomes a violent, unpredictable force, and you're flung around like a rag doll as the ocean heaves. Corridors warp and twist. Hatches snap shut like bear traps. Bad days can become bad weeks. And bad weeks can become bad voyages. Equally, when good things happen, they tend to keep happening. When it comes to the mysterious world of the ocean's depths and the secrets of the frozen far south, there seems no end to the treasures that can be bestowed upon you. Now, off the bow, port side, there's a splash. It's further off this time, maybe a mile range at a bearing of 11 o'clock. Stillness. A humpback whale comes up for air, then dives, showing the intricate beauty of its fluke to the fiery evening sky. The assembly once again becomes unsettled, anxious in anticipation. Then, an eruption. From the depths, the humpback rises with speed, breaking the surface, abandoning the underwater world, and joining life above. For an eternal moment, it hangs in the light, then crashes with a tremendous splash back to the world below. Laughter, joy, hugs. Then someone calls out that the whale has come up for air. Bated breath. Now comes the dive and the whale tail. We count, 20 seconds elapse, and the jester leaps clear into the sky again. Euphoria on the deck of the Allen K. Camera shutters click and we celebrate and mourn in equal measure. for such a perfect moment cannot truly be captured, only lived. The humpback breaches a further four times as the Allen K sails on to the southwest and into the gathering twilight. I linger on deck, reveling in the atmosphere and wondering what else lies ahead on our voyage.
I'm dubious about this vogue for distressed furniture. It seems an odd practice to apply anemic, chalky paint to a perfectly good table or dresser, then use what the DIY people call distressing mediums, sandpaper and paint stripper, to deliberately make the piece look weathered and dented. Rustic accents, knots and superficial damage are the hallmarks of shabby chic, apparently. The distressed look sometimes requires a more direct method, as the belt of a hammer is needed to batter in divots, or an awl is used to scrape the surface with a long scratch. There was no need to deliberately weather or damage the few sticks of furniture we had in my growing up years. No techniques required to add textural appeal or tonal variation. Our furniture was procured in a variety of odd ways. Maggie Rowe, whose husband Johnny worked in the meat factory, could always be relied upon to pass on unwanted pieces to us. When Johnny got a bonus, Maggie would replace the kitchen cabinet or a few chairs with new ones. The old furniture always came our way. The matter of transporting the Bounty was solved by borrowing the Clonmore Jennet. The Jennet, named Clonmore because he came from that townland, was a neat, muscular little animal whose braying delighted us. We were like frontier characters from a western when we yoked up the cart to Clonmore and led her to Rose House, where the new, second-hand furniture awaited us. Maggie's place was better than any high-end showroom, as she pointed out the kitchen cabinet or formica table destined for us. "Not a brack on it," my mother would always declare, as she slid open the doors of the cabinet or ran her fingers along the shiny veneer of formica. There would be the usual insistence that money should change hands, but Johnny would always counter this by saying he'd gotten the bonus. "There'll be plenty furniture after us," he'd add, something I still imagine I hear him say when I visit the Rose grave near to my parents' plot. No money changed hands between neighbours, but other opportunities to compensate would present themselves. We'd have an abundance of rhubarb and cabbage to share and onions to beat the band. As the furniture was roped onto the Jennet's cart, we promised we'd be back. Maggie's furniture fitted in perfectly in our house. Mishmash and mismatch was the aesthetic of our era. Our 1960s decor made plain statements about survival, but it also spoke eloquently of our efforts at variety and charm. My mother was a great one for the jumble sales in the parochial hall, where she bought the wonderful array of artwork that decorated our walls. The vintage pictures usually depicted domestic scenes reminiscent of her own childhood. A grandmother mused by an open fire, a younger woman peeled potatoes, while a child in a white pinny drew a pull-along toy over the flag floor to the amusement of a kitten. One original work took pride of place, a parrot painted by my brother Patsy. The bird splayed a gorgeous and imaginative array of cobalt and orange feathers. It was a great source of pleasure to us that the barber, Mr. Gregg, who once visited our house, was very taken by the picture. He wanted to buy it for his shop in Castle Street Care, but my parents refused. They agreed, however, that he could borrow it for a specified time. Our Patsy's parrot might as well have hung in the National Gallery, so great was our pride. Every Christmas, these paintings were removed from the walls with great care so that the elaborate frames could be gold-dusted. No restoration artist worked as diligently as my mother when she tapped out the file of gold dust into a little tin container and added in the drops of resinous oil until the solution darted like mercury. The gold dust was applied with a little brush until the frames shone with a green-gold, brassy hue. Another item of furniture that exuded glamour and romance in our house was the table, nailed together as a wedding present for my mother by a travelling man with a Hollywood name, Rupert Keating. Rupert was one of the many knights of the road who was made welcome in my mother's home place. I recall the little table as a sturdy object in the scullery. I recall, too, that my father often found fault with it. Every winter, I feared that his threat to chop it up for firewood might come treacherously to pass. I expect he felt jealous of whatever affection prompted the travelling man to knock together the table and proffer it as a gift. I wouldn't swap the second-hand furniture gifted by Maggie Rowe and carried to our house by the Clonmore Jinnet for all the Art Deco glitz in any showroom. How could the bespoke and fine-lined hold a candle to the furniture that passed from neighbour to neighbour in the unspoken understanding that we relied upon one another? What table would ever compete with a true original, a Rupert Keating creation?
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
What object would you never part with? It's a standard question in a Sunday supplement interview series that I find intriguing. My answer? A battered old wooden chest in our spare bedroom with S. Campbell, RN, stenciled in faint letters on the lid. It was in this box that my great-granduncle carried his belongings on voyages to far-flung places in the 1860s and 1870s. It's still sturdy 150 years later, even if bits are missing from some of the corners. Chewed away by rats, my granny used to say. Samuel Campbell was a surgeon in the Royal Navy. He grew up on a farm on the Fannet Peninsula in North Donegal, and maybe the sea was in his psyche, for the fields he would have played in as a child ran down to the shores of Mulroy Bay. When I was a child, playing around that same farm with my sister on summer visits, so many stories were told about Uncle Doctor, as he was known, that we sensed his presence like a benign ghost. I have the photograph album that went with him on his travels, a small book with gilt-edged pages that must have been extra precious at a time when photography was thrillingly new. I'm looking at a picture of him now, in full dress uniform, brass buttoned and braided, a well-built man with a Victorian beard and crinkly, smiling eyes. In a more informal portrait, with his cane at a jaunty angle, he looks dapper, a dandy almost, in amongst images of Disraeli, the Prince of Wales, three-masted sloops, Japanese pagodas, and his own Donegal front door. Uncle Doctor spent most of his working life on surveying expeditions. As a keen botanist, he was encouraged to take an active part in survey work besides looking after sick seamen. His service record shows these additional duties earned him an extra 2 shillings and 6 pence a day from 1859 on, a nice little bonus at the time, with nothing to spend it on for months on end. One expedition took him through the Straits of Magellan to the southernmost tip of Patagonia. Four watercolours on our living room wall, painted by the ship's artist, show him on horseback chasing llamas across the plains of Tierra del Fuego and parleying with a tribal chief. The chief has a fine-looking dog, which Uncle Sam apparently admired. Only, the story went, to be served the unfortunate hound later for dinner. He helped to chart the coasts of China, Japan and Korea, either fighting off or mollifying the locals, depending on how things went. In one of just two letters that survive, written in 1876, he describes a cruise up the North Korean coast. "We steamed into a region entirely unknown, where no European had ever been. The next day," he writes, "a village headman explained through an interpreter that his people thought the sailors had come to eat them and carry away their women." When Uncle Doctor was on leave, he returned to the family farm near Kerrykeel laden with gifts: Chinese porcelain, Japanese lacquerware, a samurai sword, a carved emu's egg, even, rather rakishly, an opium pipe. He bought gold watches for his sisters and paid the school fees of his favourite niece, Mary. Later he would take Mary to London and kit her out with fancy gowns before whisking her off to the French Riviera, where he spent the winters of his retirement. Maybe he wanted to mix with the beau monde, or maybe he had a weak chest and went there for the weather. I suspect the latter. He died of pneumonia back in Donegal, having spent too much time, they said, out on duck shoots, lying in wet heather. That was all we knew about Uncle Doctor until a letter from British Columbia landed into my grandmother's lap in 1977. It was from a librarian in Campbell River on Vancouver Island. As she must know, it said, the town had been named after Dr. Samuel Campbell. Could our family provide any information that might help a local historian to flesh out a biography? Could we what? Uncle Doctor must have done something heroic to have a town named after him. My grandmother threw herself into the task, with me as willing secretary. We drew the family tree, typed up his letters, copied photographs, recorded reminiscences. Only when the booklet was published did we learn that places marked on naval surveys were routinely given the names of any crew members at all. No heroism required. But to me, Uncle Doctor was a hero, a real traveller, instead of the tame, cosseted kind I have become. What challenges he must have faced. What, I would love to know, did he make of those very foreign countries? His sea chest holds my granny's old linen tablecloths now, and my wild imaginings.
On moving day, my husband and I meet the estate agent at our new address, to be greeted by a helium balloon from the previous owners tied to the banister. "Congratulations," it declares enthusiastically, the blue and pink design indicating it had been intended for another purpose. The estate agent hovers in the living room whilst we walk around the property, checking for what we aren't quite sure. Has the damp in the corner of the bedroom always been there? Why is there a condensation in the windows of the conservatory? I look at my husband, a familiar look of panic in both of our faces. "I leave you to it so, when you're ready," the estate agent calls from the front of the house, and off she goes, leaving us to our own devices. It's not so dissimilar to having a baby, moving house. You become so focused on the big day, it's easy to forget that all the real action takes place in the aftermath. It's not a one-day event. It's an immersion into a world of new noises and sensations, of misunderstanding and not knowing. It's your life, but not as you know it. We didn't get a manual when we became parents 13 years ago, and nor did we receive one to prepare us for the move. So here we are again, decades later, baffled by adulthood. There's so much we don't understand. The shower. What's a thermostatic valve? The hob. Why does it take so long to make scrambled eggs? Why does one radiator in the bedroom heat to a level unbearable to the touch whilst the other remains tepid? There are a few instruction leaflets left for kitchen appliances, but mostly we're left to figure it out ourselves. We have to be grown-ups. The biggest mystery is the switch in the living room. It sits just above the skirting board to the right of the fireplace. It looks like a light switch, but when you flick it, no lights come on. Instead, a gasping, gurgling noise rises through the walls, like a belch. This house, like the metaphorical baby, can't keep quiet. It's constantly whining, groaning, burping. We organise a roofer to come and look at the roof, hoping it'll fix the apparent leak in our son's bedroom. The roofers arrive and do the job. Then they tell us there's more work to be done. So they come back again the next day and do that. We allow ourselves a moment's smug satisfaction at getting things done. After a few days, I notice a stain on the floor in the living room. Two grey spots at the corner by the door from the hall. I glance up and sure enough, there is the shadowy telltale sign of water trickling in from the ceiling above. By now, we have unboxed the majority of our belongings, or at least the ones we use on a regular basis. I have created a cosy reading nook for myself in the living room. My old reading chair, our old IKEA bookcases filled with my favourite books. And yet everything looks unfamiliar in its new home. It's very disconcerting, an uncanny version of our lives. The furniture we have brought is contemporary, functional. The decor on this house is, let's say, traditional. They are mismatched. It's like looking in the mirror and expecting to see the 20-year-old version of yourself, only to be confronted with a 43-year-old who looks kind of like you, except really tired. But the living room is my favourite room in the house so far. It's south-facing, a fact I only learned by downloading the Compass app onto my phone. And when the sun comes in through the large window, even in February, the whole room is warmed. The wallpaper is yellow, the reading chair and matching footstool are yellow, the daffodils. It's like sitting in the oozing yolk of a perfectly poached egg. Delicious. I put my feet up and bask in the sun like a contented cat. The leaks are all fixed. The shower is hot, the hob and the heating mastered. The mysterious switch is the only puzzle remaining to be solved. After 2 weeks, we admit defeat and email the estate agent. Would it be possible to ask the previous owners what the switch in the living room does?
Family now. Somehow we got together and it's forever now.
After a lapse of almost 40 years, I can still recall the excitement my wife Greta and I felt as we set off for a new life in Australia in 1985 with a baby and a toddler in tow. We were bound for Greta's home city of Perth, where I was to teach at a university there. During the 2 years I spent in what locals call WA, I came to love the wide-open spaces of that vast territory, similar in scale to the whole of Western Europe, but with a tiny population of just over 1 million at that time. I took a particular interest in Western Australia's rich Irish connections, epitomised by Clareman Paddy Hannan, who discovered gold there in 1890, triggering the last great Australian gold rush and setting off a mining boom that continues to this day. Then there was the Irish engineer C.Y. O'Connor, who was responsible for building the port of Fremantle and the waterworks that supplied the burgeoning mining communities of Coolgardie and Kalgoorlie at the turn of the 19th century. Today, O'Connor is memorialised with an equestrian statue on a Perth beach that now bears his name. After two happy years in Perth, Greta and I returned to Ireland, so that I could resume my position in our diplomatic service. In the years that followed, we continued to return to Perth as often as finances would permit. We paid a visit last year to mark my retirement and Greta's significant birthday. Travelling up the coast from the wine-producing area of Margaret River, on a quiet stretch of road on the shores of the Indian Ocean, in a grove of trees, I came across a memorial that highlights another Irish connection with that faraway land. It remembers the Fenian John Boyle O'Reilly, who was born in County Meath on the eve of the Great Famine. He was involved in newspaper work in Ireland and Britain before joining the British Army. O'Reilly was convicted of recruiting servicemen into the Fenians and was transported to Western Australia in 1867. The cell he occupied in Fremantle Prison can still be visited, but the indomitable O'Reilly did not remain there for long. Aided by a local Irish priest, Father Patrick McCabe, O'Reilly escaped on board an American whaling ship and made his way to the United States, arriving in Philadelphia in November 1869. He subsequently settled in the Boston area, where he continued his involvement with Irish nationalism, working with fellow Fenians to organise the celebrated rescue of six Fenian prisoners from Western Australia on board the Catalpa. O'Reilly's writing and editorial skills stood to him in his new home. He became editor and owner of the Boston Pilot, at that time the leading Catholic newspaper in America. He did a considerable service to Irish literature by publishing regular essays by W.B. Yeats, in which he elaborated some of the ideas that powered the Irish literary revival of the 1890s. The fee of £1 for each article when it arrived through Yeats's letterbox was always a welcome source of financial relief to the impecunious poet. O'Reilly became a prominent figure during America's Gilded Age, befriending the leading American writers of that time, Longfellow and Emerson. His sympathies ranged well beyond the concerns of Irish Americans, and he argued for improved conditions for workers and for fairer treatment of African Americans during the repressive Jim Crow era that followed the American Civil War. One of his best-known poems celebrates Crispus Attucks, a man of African and Native American extraction who was killed during the Boston Massacre of 1770, which brought about the American War of Independence. For the egalitarian O'Reilly, there was never a separate heartbeat in all the races of men. John Boyle O'Reilly also praised the exploits of the Irish Brigade at the Battle of Fredericksburg, who charged for their flag to the grim cannon's mouth. I have visited that Civil War battlefield and seen for myself how brave the Irish needed to be to run up that hill under intense fire. With an inclusiveness typical of him, O'Reilly recognised too the valour of those Irish who fought on the Confederate side. His conclusion was that, "Who loveth the flag is a man and a brother, no matter what birth or what race or what creed." John Boyle O'Reilly was just 46 years old when he died in 1890 of an accidental overdose of sleeping medicine. His death was widely mourned, and his funeral was attended by the US President Benjamin Harrison. During my visit to Western Australia last year, I had a further brush with the O'Reilly legend as I watched Ireland play Scotland in the Rugby Six Nations at the John Boyle O'Reilly pub in a Perth suburb, complete with a replica of the rowing boat in which he made his initial escape. I found myself surrounded by a new generation of Irish exiles, totally different from those O'Reilly wrote of in his poem The Exile of the Gael, whose songs, he said, were saddened by thoughts of desolate days. In an exuberant throng of young Irish toasting another Irish rugby triumph, there was no hint of Desolation Row on that balmy night in Perth.
Tired of planning and toiling in the crowded hives of men, heart weary of building and spoiling and spoiling and building again.
A couple of years ago, there was an exhibition in Dublin Castle called The Objects of Love. It gathered together memorabilia left behind by the family of Oliver Sears, which was brutally dispersed in Nazi-occupied Poland. I wrote this piece in response to the exhibition. It's called Visible Mending. Consider textiles. The warmth of a woolen jumper. The comfort of cashmere. The airtight insulation of fur. Consider how uniquely human it is to fabricate clothing and wear it